One pinprick mark was clearly visible on the inside of her index finger, and a 1/8-inch diameter elongated red scrape mark with a pinprick inside it was on the base of the thumb. These marks healed in 5 days' time with no medical attention. Her mother said Sarah's eye pupils were dilated and that she had washed off some of the redness on her face the next morning. She had done this out of curiosity and fear. By the morning of the 5th, the dilation was gone, her mother said. Muscat asked Sarah what was the thing you said I wouldn't believe. She replied, I was on board a UFO. Muscat, Sarah and her brother, Jay, went to the site, where they saw a triangular area of depressed grass which had a grey pallor as if the chlorophyll had gone from it. The measurements that Muscat took the corresponded very closely to the description by Sarah. Muscat photographed her hand, the matted down area, and called Larry Fenwick and Harry Tuckers. All three went to Sarah's house to ask for further details. Following this, they proceeded to the field. There, she showed them approximately where she had awakened. During the search for the exact location, Sarah noticed a nickel and a penny lying on the grass. She searched her pockets, telling them she had 11 cents the previous day. She only found a nickel in her pocket. This money was found at the location at which she had awoke, 15 feet from where the grass was matted down and dried out. On August 7, Claude Freeman, Q-Forn member and pilot, was asked to get a Geiger counter to check for radiation. That night very heavy rain fell, preventing use of the Geiger counter. On the 8th, Freeman and Henning Jorgensen, Q-Forn radar and electronics expert, took radiation readings, while Muscat obtained soil samples. The readings were 1.6 to 1.7 higher than the normal background radioactive scintillations. Geiger readings were taken in areas as far as 5 feet away from the depressed area. The readings ranged from 14 to 19 at that distance. Inside the depressed area, they ranged from 23 to 34 scintillations per minute. Muscat interviewed Kathy on August 9. Kathy described her observations of August 2. She said the arrowhead object had a red mist around it. It was silent and, inside the red mist, the surface appeared white and smooth. It hovered and moved up and down slowly. She said that at arm's length the object would have been the size of an automobile. On all three nights, the weather was clear and warm. There were many stars in view and the moonlight ranged in intensity, from dull to bright. There were a few fluffy white clouds on the night of August 2. Kathy said the arrowhead object came from the northwest on August 2. She said there were 6 objects in view that night. She also noted that the wind was almost non-existent, and was from the southeast. The edges of the arrowhead object appeared sharp. The bottom looked like pipes on the bottom of a car. Sarah said that on the sightings of the 2nd, she began to cry while she watched the oval object and could not believe what she was seeing. Kathy also said that on the 2nd, she saw an orange-red ball of fire. Kathy said that on the afternoon of the 4th, some friends helped her get up on the school roof, where she saw oil and half-square marks. These were no longer visible a day later, when investigators arrived. Q-Forn contacted a doctor who specializes in hypnosis in Toronto. Regressive hypnosis sessions took place on October 10th. 18th and 24th, with Sarah TMS mother present. The doctor TMS name is omitted here as he does not want to be bombarded by phone calls from persons who wish to have regressive hypnosis. He prefers to be contacted by Q-Forn. The following is a summary of the tape recorded regressive hypnosis sessions. For coherence, a few statements made in the 2nd session are included with those of the 1st session. October 10, 1979, Sarah said she was taken on foot through the UFO's wall. The interior was brightly and uniformly lit throughout and sharper than regular lighting. Sarah detected the odor of chicken. Her hands went through everything she touched, except for an ordinary cat from Earth. She was told they had been growing it on board and it was to be released eventually. The creature had not done any tests on the cat, which roamed around freely on the UFO. She said there were 7 shadowy creatures on the UFO and that she could see right through them. They were long and oval, like large American-style footballs and were 4 feet tall. They appeared crystalline. Each was of a different, but strange color. They told her telepathically that they had taken her for tests to see what humans are made of. They said they had been on Earth before and would return when she was 25. She felt she was on board for what seemed like a year. Doctor, did you stay here on Earth and just look at it from the air? Sarah, yes. I saw the whole world. Doctor, did they take you to any other world? Sarah, well, they showed me this place. It's real and it's there, but it's not. Doctor, was it another planet or star? Sarah, yes. Doctor, do you remember what they did to you that made your skin become tanned, sort of like a sunburn? Sarah, the bright lights. They've got to stay on. They have to have light. Doctor, why? Sarah, to keep them alive. Doctor, why did the bright lights only cause sort of a sunburn on your face and neck and not on your hands? Sarah, cause my hands were glowing. Doctor, do you know why they were glowing? Sarah, number, October 18, 1979, second session. Sarah described the physical examination administered to her. They put an instrument in her mouth. A light was put on her thumb and index finger, which painlessly burned holes in each of them. Blood was extracted from the holes. A machine was placed on her head to find out what I know. She asked the creatures where they were from, but she said she did not know what the answer was. Sarah saw an ordinary English-speaking human man on the UFO. He said he was there for the same tests. He told her his first name only, but she recalled merely that it began with an A. He was from here, Sarah said, but not from her neighborhood. The man said he was taken aboard after she arrived on the UFO. He stayed on board after she was let go. The creatures told her that they were going to let him go after they had released her. This man may or may not be a Canadian. I told her he did not mind being on the UFO. He asked the creatures questions when Sarah was present, but Sarah could not recall them. I had dark hair, which was going a bit gray. He looked about 43. He was not very tall and wore casual clothing. He told Sarah he was a store owner. Sarah said there were a lot of plants and computers on board, although most of the computers were in another room which she got a glimpse of. Doctor, how did you get off the UFO? Sarah, they took me out the door. It wasn't a different color door. It was just a little hole in the wall. I went through a little hole. And then they put me back to sleep and then I was on the ground. Doctor, do you remember how they put you to sleep? Sarah, yes. Doctor, how? Sarah, they told me to go to sleep. Doctor, does it still seem very real to you or does it seem like a distant dream? Sarah, I'd say real. Doctor, were you frightened at all? Sarah, number. Doctor, did you feel they were good people, good beings? Sarah, yes. October 24, 1979, third session. Note, the incident referred to here occurred on October 11, 1979, one day after the first session. Doctor, what are you seeing? Sarah, a funny man. He's tall, skinny, and he's got funny-looking shoes on. Doctor, how are the shoes funny-looking? Sarah, I don't know. They're just funny. Sarah told the doctor she was in the school courtyard at lunchtime along with her friends. He had followed her to the courtyard from the cafeteria. The MIB came over to her and told her to move away from where her friends were. Then he started asking questions. She said he wanted desperately to find out who her friends were. Doctor, he gave you no reason why he wanted to know? Sarah, I think he wanted to kill them. Doctor, why? Did he think they were dangerous? Sarah, yes, I guess. The man in black said he had a lot of partners everywhere. He warned her that if she did not tell him about everything on board the UFO that he and his friends would get after her. And if she went away from him while he was talking to her, he would scare her again. She thought about calling for help, but could not because the man's mind was stronger than hers. Sarah told him exactly what she had seen and heard on the UFO. He seemed pleased with her information, only showing surprise when she mentioned the computers. He said he knew there was a man on the UFO. He told her that he had spoken to the human man since that time. Doctor, how did your conversation end? Sarah, he just went. Doctor, you mean just walked away? Sarah, no, he just disappeared. Doctor, right in front of you? Sarah, yes. Doctor, do you think that he was human? Sarah, number. Sarah had told Muscat about the man in black on October 12th. She said he stood 6 feet tall and looked like a dead person. He had a dull gray-toned face, slanted eyes and wore a black suit. Sarah could not remember the shape of the lips, but recalled that his grin was sinister. He had a very pointed nose and long fingernails on tapering fingers. His feet were pointing outward at 90 degrees. His shoes had 3 to 4 inch heels. In a summary of the sessions, the doctor noted that Sarah had been taken to a psychiatrist several months before her experience as a result of school problems, the strains of adolescent adjustments and sibling rivalry. He said she had a vivid imagination and had claimed to have seen some bizarre-looking ghosts. She had a very strong interest in the occult for the past few years, but, according to her mother, not much interest in UFOs. She had not read books or magazines on the UFO subject. The doctor said the UFO incidents began on July 23rd, whereas the three-night sequence of sightings started on August 2nd. He mentioned that Sarah claimed to have seen some UFOs on that night and the two succeeding evenings. He used the word claimed, although he admitted he did not investigate the sightings by other people in the area at the time. The doctor commented that Sarah was remarkably nonchalant about the entire experience both before and after the hypnosis. This was her attitude toward her father's death, he added. Her nonchalance concerning his demise was understandable due to a reason which must remain confidential. Her casual attitude toward the UFO incidents is partly explained by the absence of serious side effects on her. An important point to note is that she told Q-Forms investigators that the experience inside the UFO was moderately pleasant. He said the Hines girl seemed candidly surprised to hear what she had said under hypnosis when the tapes were played back to her. He said her casual attitude returned after her initial surprise. What he does not know is that, from the moment Q-Forn was in touch with her and up to a week after the hypnosis was complete, Q-Forn's investigators repeatedly told her to be calm about the incident. She was told that abductions are not as unusual as most people think and that any side effects on her would disappear very shortly. In other words, the investigators conditioned her to a casual attitude. This attitude conditioning was referred to by Q-Forn member John Musgrave, in his article, The UFO Investigator as Counselor and Healer, Proceedings of the 1976 QFOS Conference, pages 198-200. The hypnotherapist said that subjects do not have to relate the truth while questioned under hypnosis. If Sarah was lying, the doctor would not have said that she experienced genuine surprise at hearing a playback of the tapes of the hypnotic sessions. Others with years of experience in the UFO field have stated that subjects cannot lie under deep hypnosis. These include Dr. R. Leo Sprinkle, University of Wyoming, and Dr. James A. Harder. Dr. Alvin Lawson, in What Can We Learn from Hypnosis of Imaginary Abductees? 1977 MUFON UFO Symposium Proceedings, pages 107-131. Stated that it is possible to lie under deep hypnosis only when subjects are deliberately told to imagine an event and are fed leading questions and outright suggestions. After the first session, Q-Forn's Larry Fenwick asked the doctor if he would monitor Sarah RTMS bodily direct current electrical field in subsequent sessions. This technique was suggested by Dr. Harold A. Kahn, a clinical hypnotist, in his article, Use of Hypnosis to Discriminate True and False UFO Experiences, the APRO Bulletin, March, 1979, pages 4-5. Kahn said when a subject is faking there is either no great DC potential charge, no trance, or whatever verbal account they present is obviously derivative. The doctor declined Fenwick's suggestion, saying that the device is unreliable, despite the fact that he has never used the instrument. The hypnotist said that the sessions should stop because of the death of Sarah's father and her recent depressed state. However, the threat by the man in black at the school may have been the real reason for discontinuing the hypnotic regression. Possibly, deeper hypnosis could elicit much information from Sarah. Although they are omitted in this article, 5 times during the hypnosis she said "I don't remember," indicating that mental blocks may have been implanted in her subconscious by the alien entities. It is ironic that the doctor stated that he hoped his summary will be of use to you and your colleagues in attempting to get a better understanding of the UFO phenomena, sick. The doctor's written summary made no reference to the taped session describing the man in black. He did not mention that Sarah saw a cat inside the UFO. He did not refer to the photos Muscat showed him of the marks on her thumb and finger and that her mother noted that the pupils of Sarah's eyes were dilated for 12 hours. In the summary and in a conversation with Harry Tukas, Joe Muscat and Larry Fenwick, the doctor said that Sarah told him under hypnosis that she heard buzzing and beeping sounds when she was aboard the UFO. Her account of this was not on the tapes. Q Forms Joe Muscat arranged for soil sample analysis, which was done on August 17, at the Radiation Protection Laboratory, Special Studies and Services Branch, Ministry of Labour, at Ontario Government Offices in Toronto. ROI readout time was 2,000 seconds for gross counts inside the area where the depressed grass was found. Naturally occurring radon daughters ranged from 123 to 178, with a naturally occurring annihilation peak of 256. Cesium-137, a long-lined fallout nuclide reached a peak of 331. Potassium-40, naturally occurring, was also noted. Radiation accounts for the soil ranged from 3 to 83, with an average count of 44. The counts for the background or normal soil outside the site ranged from 1 to 23, averaging out to 6.743. Thus, the affected soil was more than 6 times as high in radiation as the soil outside the site, even after a heavy rainstorm. In the light of the doctor's lack of involvement with this and the other facets of the investigation, it is not surprising to Q-Form that he made the following statement: "I do not believe that any conclusive judgment can be made at this time regarding the validity of her account." In contrast, and in conclusion, Q-Form judges that this was a genuine double abduction incident. An alien in our midst. Throughout the years there have been widely circulated rumors indicating that extraterrestrials have already infiltrated into our society and are at this very moment walking unhindered and defiant amongst us. Exponents of this ever-growing theory maintain the reason they are not easily detected is because like chameleons, with the ability to blend in perfectly with their surroundings, of these alien beings have the power to literally hypnotize human beings into believing they are as normal-looking as you and I. Others who postulate on this are of the firm opinion that any abnormality that may show is simply chalked up to some mental disturbance. Society is filled with individuals who just don't fit in. There are the vagrants who inhabit the streets day and night, the shopping bag ladies who call the city's subways their home, and the crazies who we try to avoid every day. We simply shake our heads at these unfortunate ones and continue on about our business, often closing our eyes totally to that which we live side by side with, a shut away from our world but part of it nevertheless. You've just got to talk to this fellow. He's no crackpot. I had been a guest on the Larry Ford talk show several times. A veteran of Pittsburgh radio, Larry has a keen interest in the offbeat, and he's not afraid to air the views of experts in a wide range of controversial fields. As usual, Larry was right in his character analysis. Pittsburgh musician Tony V. recently came face to face with a man whose unusual behavior and strange abilities rate him as being mighty peculiar in anybody's book. For anyone who can vanish without walking away, who can materialize behind locked hospital doors in the middle of the night, and who is the possessor of highly unusual body characteristics, is certainly strange, as you are likely to agree as you read further along in this amazing incident. Being a musician, I get to play in some pretty unusual places, the talented drummer points out. Tony has done the circuit of bars, concert halls and after-hours clubs. It's simply a part of his job or what he does in order to make a living. Tony remarks that a lot of the bars he performs in are packed to the rafters on weekends. They're the types of places where the girls come to dance and the guys come to pick up chicks. One evening, Tony was standing near the bar in one of these places when he was suddenly engaged in conversation by a stranger. He said his name was Robert and that he was interested in astronomy and UFOs. Someone, he said, had told him that I was interested in the same subjects and he felt we might have something in common. Tony brought out that the man said he lived around Arnold, Pennsylvania, and had read lots of books about flying saucers. At that point, Tony didn't feel anything was out of place. Then the man began discussing Frank Edwards, author of several bestsellers on UFOs. My new companion then made a rather strong statement. You know he's dead. ATM and when I told him I hadn't realized the fact, he continued, saying, you wouldn't want to know what happened to him. Tony said the man's voice was rather ominous as though his words were meant to be a warning or some type of threat. From Tony's description, we can determine that the individual who called himself Robert was very cold and calculating. He was also quite peculiar in that he was abnormally thin compared to the woman he almost always came into the bar with, who was exceedingly fat. The woman was supposedly Robert's wife. As a further description, Tony says the man was Caucasian, but with yellowish skin, as though he were suffering from jaundice, a disease due to excretion of bile pigments in the blood, characterized by yellowness of the skin. His eyes were slanted, but he wasn't Oriental. He was about 5'7" and his hairline came to a widow's beak. I never saw him dress in anything but black. His manner of speech was low and sort of stiff. He did not have a good command of English, although he seemed to have knowledge of science. Tony explained, the three of us were seated at one of the tables one night when Robert suddenly passed out. It was as though he'd had a caesura, that is, he just keeled over. He was out cold. I tried to revive him, but there was no sign of a heartbeat. Tony says that he and another customer picked up the man and took him to Tony's van, which was parked outside. I was going to drive him to the hospital, even though it appeared that he was dead. This was when Tony noticed that the man had some very strange physical characteristics. I unbuttoned his shirt, and I saw that he had absolutely no body hair. In addition, he had no belly button, nor nipples. Apparently, the man came to, and apologized for being trouble. The really strange thing was that his wife seemed to be unconcerned about her husband's condition. She didn't try to help us and went about her business as though nothing had happened which was out of the ordinary. As peculiar as that night might have been, Tony tried to push Robert out of his mind. I had dislocated my shoulder and was in extreme pain. He checked into a private room in one of the area hospitals and completely forgot about the incident involving the strange man at the bar. While I was in the hospital, Robert came to visit me a few times to see how I was getting along. I really didn't have much to say to him, but I figured it was nice to have a visitor in my condition. It wasn't until Robert showed up at the hospital in the wee hours that Tony began to put two and two together. I really don't know how he got into the hospital or past the security desk at that hour, but I awoke at about 3 a.m., and there he was, standing right beside my bed. Having been under sedation at the time, Tony was extremely tired and couldn't talk to the man. I just sort of told him to come back later, at another time. It was as though he had materialized in the hospital room and just as suddenly vanished into thin air. As far as his interest in UFOs went, Tony says the individual who called himself Robert had a technical fascination with the subject. He was interested in the mechanics of how these interstellar craft operate. One night, after I'd been out of the hospital for some time, he called me up and said to meet him in a rather isolated wooded area about 40 miles north of Pittsburgh. He said that he wanted to show me something. being that it was such a desolated spot and that I was beginning to feel increasingly uncomfortable around him, I decided to ask a friend of mine to come along for the ride. Then, together, Tony and his friend drove to a spot very near the river. We sat in the car waiting for him. It was a cold day and so we were anxious for him to show up. We never did hear or see a vehicle approach, but from out of nowhere he was standing in front of our automobile. Tony maintains that the man seemed unduly upset because the musician had not come alone. My friend was almost laughing at this guy, that's how strange he looked. It was kind of comical. I couldn't hear him speak, his mouth didn't move here, but I had the distinct impression that he was in a bad mood. He repeated several times the phrase, "You must get out of here. It's dangerous." 1 minute Robert was beside the car and the next he was inside in the back seat. If he opened the door I didn't see him. Tony can't swear that it was a case of walking through a solid car door or of teleportation, but doesn't rule these possibilities out completely. Tony never did find out why he was asked to come to this particular area. There has been any number of UFO sightings and landings in Pennsylvania over the years, but none that I know of in this vicinity. Because of what had transpired, Tony didn't want anything more to do with the man as he thought he was quite dangerous. One of the girls, who hung out at the bar where Robert usually showed up, said he scared the hell out of her just by being around. She wanted to know why I associated with characters like this. Anyway, he telephoned me again one night and said he had to see me once more, and I told him in no uncertain terms to get lost, that I really had no time for this kind of stuff. It was just so weird how he always wore the same clothes, the same black pants, the same black shirt, and the same, very cheap-looking black sports coat. He would give the creeps to a ghost. At around this time, Tony's arm started acting up again, and he wasn't able to play for a while. About 5 months later, I went back to drumming in the same after-hours bar and I just happened to ask the owner if he's seen my peculiar-looking friend. I was told he hadn't been in the place since I'd stopped playing. I asked Tony if he'd noticed anything else particularly unusual about the man in black. Tony thought about the question for a few minutes before answering. He would never drink. He didn't smoke, and for the life of me I never saw him eat anything. As far as UFOs are concerned, Tony feels this person knew quite a bit about the subject. I'm pretty well read on the topic and know more than the average person. However, he knew a whole lot more. He would talk a great deal about how UFOs actually ran, and he went into this big spiel about radio waves, and concentrated radio beams which I couldn't make heads nor tails of. At times he sounded like a physics professor, while on other occasions he said some really stupid things. Several times the man talked about how he wanted to actually capture an alien. He had this device which he said told him when UFOs would appear at certain times of the year. He said this contraption would make a huge beacon, like a homing device would. It was really off the wall. Tony doesn't know what to make of the incident. He isn't 100% positive, he's not having any concrete proof that Robert was a genuine alien, but then again so many strange things happened in connection with this man that he isn't willing to rule out this possibility. Tony would like to know the truth, but he isn't about to spend the rest of his life searching for it by tracing down this man. If he should show up again, he's quite ready to ask him all kinds of questions. But in the meanwhile, he's more concerned with his musical career. Tony's group has been getting quite a bit of attention and their music has begun to get airplay on some radio stations. Maybe fortune will be good and he'll make it to a right to the top. Then he'll be among a select group of celebrities whose talents may be known all about in some pretty distant places. The MD and MIB, Dr. Herbert Hopkins of Orchard Beach, Maine, is no cook or crackpot. In fact, up until he became involved in using hypnosis on a young man who claims to have undergone a series of UFO-related experiences, the reputable physician hadn't paid that much attention to flying saucers, although he admits that he read an occasional magazine article on the subject. Usually, though, he refused to take the matter seriously, feeling that the reality of UFOs could not be proven or disproved. It was not until he received a telephone call from a woman friend who was interested in probing the subconscious of a youth named David Stevens, that Dr. Hopkins ever had any first-hand dealings with this field. A bright and intelligent person, he isn't by any stretch of the imagination an overzealous investigator of such unexplained phenomena.